So, it's great to see so many familiar faces. Some faces that I really missed recently. Other faces that I still saw recently, which is also nice to have those present here. And yeah, this is of course a special welcome and a special event, which is why I appreciate your presence even more. And all the time when I'm looking at you, I'm seeing nice new people. And I can talk today about a topic that I'm really passionate about. And that topic has to do with how communication contributes to the big challenges of our current times. And it's also about a book, a new book. And actually, it is my 15th book. But I thought now I could give it an open access, also as a gift to you, because I've had a wonderful time here in Finland, 11 years working for this esteemed university. When I left the Netherlands, it was a quite different situation, because there I had a very tight network. I was a communication manager of two different national organizations. I was doing spokespeople work, lobbying in parliament, and a lot of sector-related policy making and advising. At about the same time, I was also a frequent speaker, and I was a consultant in company mergers and in some complex change situations, also advising some board members, for example, in a period of union strikes. So it was all very, very hectic. And now I was so surprised after these 11 years that in the springtime I was still ranked somewhere on the list of females in my discipline. And that must have been probably because one of my books had a 10th edition. Over 15 years, I had the opportunity to, so I felt really blessed that I had this opportunity to still fill in a lot of matters, new matters about social media, etc., in this 10th edition. But it also said in this ranking about me, she is literally hiding currently in the Finnish forests. Well, maybe some people were thinking that. Maybe that is about to change, who knows. But in Finland, I had hardly a public role. It was no comparison. On the other hand, I had much more of a life, so that was great. And I could focus really on the team, on the discipline, the students, international research projects. And, of course, as earlier in my career, that made no difference at all. I was still doing double hours. And that was also possible because I had a husband that did not have a job in Finland. So I could totally focus on it. I sat too much, I gained weight, but that is now all going to change. It was not only double hours. I must say that it also was more than double pleasure. I really enjoyed that. And end of 2006, when I came here already, I was focused, I saw the importance of the topic of change. And it was, I should say, but also using the next slide, it was also this nice conference, the UPRIRA 2010 scientific conference, that we could get to Jyväskylä, and that I co-organized together with some others, among which one person is sitting there. How nice that you are here, Paulina Portola. And so at that time, change already fascinated me. But I would say that it gained urgency over the years, and it now is really urgent. Communication and crisis communication has long already been an important topic for our discipline. And I should also reference here to Jaco Lehtonen, my predecessor professor emeritus, who already was investigating and publishing about crisis communication. Maybe I did it a bit different way because I wanted to use primarily funded projects, but that has changed over the years. And of course, I also have opinions, but I won't bother you about them now. But if you want to know, there's a blog that I've written about changes in funding and what that means currently for universities and also especially for us professors. But I try to do it through projects. And you see here three European projects, and I'm also very happy that of all three projects, the key researcher is present here. So, wonderful. Next to that, we also did projects with TECAS funding, CITRA funding, Swedish MBA funding, and very proud we were with the collaboration with the Prime Minister's Office and other Finnish authorities. So we tried to connect with international scholars, but also, for example, with Pelastusopisto. Thank you for being here today, Hannu Rantanen. We collaborated with the police and also with a lot of consultancies in public relations that are local or national in Finland. So let's go to the new book. The new book. It relates to communication supporting organizational transitions as well as resilience. And in that book come together a lot of different inputs gained from this consultancy work, from the doctoral thesis, because collaborating with 8 people that got their degree in this period of 11 years, and 2 that are now waiting for their defense, tomorrow one, and 3 more that I expect will be recently ready, and then there's still 2 others also that I'm working with, but that's a source of inspiration. And the topics that come together in this book began with media developments, crisis communication, but also issues and innovation. And of course, it's also great to see some people here from the innovation project that we ran, Wilma and me together, the AVI project. Thank you. But, yes, what I would like to stress is that communication in such turbulent times, especially it needs sense-making. Sense-making and in times of change, we need to strengthen our relations. We need to partner with a lot of different actors in order to cope with such crises. Yeah, so of course, I wrote that down not to forget it, and I was actually forgetting it, so I was a bit like, oh, what should I tell you? But I want to stress something that's very obvious to me, but that wasn't so obvious when I began here, that communication is definitely not the communications means part that contributes to other disciplines, but it is a discipline in its own. It's a functional area without which many organizations are not able to deal with all these frequent changes that are nowadays going on. That's why we also have own strategy maps, for example, to explain that. Let's go to these turbulent times. Transboundary crisis we have nowadays with an increased complexity. And that calls for a flexible and also mindful approach, using a term of Carl Weick. Fast communication also facilitated by ICT. And what you see here, there's a plane in the Hudson River. I'm on a boat to pick up people out of the water. Total madness. That was only, I mean, it's not that long ago, 2009. And that was one of the first moments that worldwide people were using social media during crises to report what was happening. And that, of course, the use of social media has changed our crisis communication, but also crisis management a lot. And I should add to that that only I think it was 2 days ago, that American scholars, we had an email conversation, and they told me that the 911 centers in the States quickly overloaded, and this is about Houston. And the residents then took en masse to Facebook and Twitter to get help of the Coast Guard. And the Coast Guard used that social media input together with geo-tracking. So you can see that in between 2009, when we have these first tweets going on, and very recently in Houston, using geo-tracking to get, because 911 was really overloaded, and it also worked, meaning that people who stepped on board, rescue people on board of helicopters, had special equipment with them to use special software to combine this geo-tracking with using social media. And now, all over the States, people are trying to be prepared for such situations. It may also change habits in Europe, even though we are still trying to hold on to the 112. But let's see if this is also going to change anyhow. For them, it wasn't a choice. So there is a diversity of risks, which means that there also is a high diversity of communication needs. You see on the left above the situation of terrorism, where high impact and consequences are noted beyond, you could say, the casualties caused. It has a global effect. And on the second picture, on the right above, you see SARS, an infectious disease, and that reminds us of all that lack of knowledge that people have about such viruses, and that also for communication make it very difficult to put boundaries around a target group, because people are traveling and the virus is traveling also in sometimes very unexpected patterns. So our whole approach of looking for target groups is very different in such biological hazards. And then we see something perhaps you can guess. It looks like micro. And it is, of course, relating to cybersecurity affecting us all. For example, hacking or other criminal activities. The economical crisis is shown on the right below, where you saw that banking and societal crises got very much interlinked. So is crisis management nowadays still done to counteract incidents as one-time events and then get back to normal? I'd rather say no. It has changed. The world is now so fluid that we need a different view on change, building strong but very flexible organizations. Another reason for this is that disruptions are so costly to society. Change is not an exception anymore, but change is now a constantly present factor. Some changes evolve slow and allow organizations to adapt or even influence their surroundings. And other changes can be seen as very fast happening crises or disruptions that maybe change the whole functioning of a market. So how to become an anti-fragile, to speak with a word that also Wilma has used a lot, an anti-fragile organization, a resilient organization, and we need to rethink these disruptive changes in the market. I'll try to address more of that in this speech. But first, I would really like to know something of you. How do you see this question? There has been a long debate about it among scholars. Are there more crises nowadays or not? And before we're doing some buzzing, my question would first be, I would like to simply see some hands. Who are thinking, no, there were always many crises around this globe? And who say no to this question? Okay, sorry. Do I ask it right? Not more, always many. Thank you. Yeah. Who are saying yes to this question? I would say it's almost in balance. That will be very interesting. Please buzz with your neighbor about this question, and then Jenny Huberine will pick up some of your answers. Thank you.
Attention, please. Let's start. And I'm giving the first opportunity to comment to Hannu Rantanen.
Sorry.
So we have this mic that you can talk to and then throw it to the next person. So Hannu, how do you see that? Are there more crises nowadays than there used to be?
Yeah, I'll stand up because I usually like to be seen when I'm talking and to be brief, to be appreciated. So, in my opinion, there has always been crisis, but there are, I think, two things now that might be, like, if you're talking about this social media and these type of things. For instance, in Europe, there are more and more crises that come so close to each other, are close to us, so everybody is sort of affected with everything that has happening all over the world. And then the other thing is that there might be that it's a little bit more turbulent also for Europe, as it has been always turbulent in all other parts of the world. But maybe we are seeing a little bit more turbulence here in Europe at the moment. But as a whole, the whole world is not more crisis-prone than previously, in my opinion. Okay. And
thank you.
There.
Please go ahead. Do you agree with him or...?
Well, we kind of agreed with him. We were thinking that nowadays that the social media is even more active in the everyday life. We think that we get to see more of the crises that happen all around the world. So in that sense, we know more of the crises that happened around the world that we knew before. So in that sense, we know more about the crisis happening.
Please pass on the microphone to over that side of the room.
Let's hear one more comment on the topic.
Well, in my personal opinion, I think, you know, there are more crises nowadays. It's not just because of Trump and other people in other places. But when you see something on the social media or on the media, it also affects you. I mean, it's a ripple effect kind of thing. And in the olden days, you know, some of the crises were not reported. You were not affected by it. So I think there are more crises than before. But that's, again, my personal opinion. There are no statistical proofs to say that, yeah.
Thank you. Anybody
who wants to catch it?
No, I think this is a good enough start. Yeah, so you can keep that mic for a while. If you let it stand still, it will automatically tune out. So if it's not moving, it will stop, and then you're safe talking to your neighbor in the next instance. Thank you, Jenny. So let's take a look. Well, I would like to give a comment, which means that yes, of course, both everything that you said is also reflected in the scholarly debate about this. My personal view is that because we hear indeed, so that is also, yeah, I think in that way said, we hear more about it and there are these ripple effects that go further because systems are so interrelated. So in that sense, you may more often be facing a crisis in a direct or indirect way. But the number of crises might not, but there's more of those crises that also affect your home bases because their effects ripple further so that more systems, more places could be affected. So, and that is, I think, an answer somewhere safely in the middle also. Okay, let's take a look at risks, but also at issues. And on the above, you see the organization-related risks, and below, you see the broader risks. So, for example, on the left above, we can talk about the production process or product failure. That's a clearly organization-related risk. Whereas when we go to the right above, we see organization-related issues. An example of that is a policy-related issue, for example, a corporate social responsibility issue. And then below, we see the broader risks. And for example, we already addressed terrorism. And a broader issue that we can mention is, for example, the theme of immigration being discussed now, especially in Europe, but I would say in many, many different areas of the world. So I was thinking, from the perspective of an organization, can I maybe arrange it even more clearly? And then I came up with these two that again have these secret color codes in purple and green, where you see to the green side those organization-related crises that can be the consequence of a risk or an issue. Where you see production process, policy-related miscellaneous, reputation issues. And there, actually, I started to write. I wrote mainly in the beginning about organizational reputation crises. But when I came here, I was more on that green side, in these, at least in those internationally funded projects, where we talked about natural disasters, but also man-made incidents, and hazardous materials, and violent conflict, and terrorism. But in the middle, of course, there is that group of industrial accidents, so caused within an organization, but having large-scale effects. Of course, they can also go together somehow. That may remind you of TEPCO. Strange enough, many people think of the Fukushima crisis, whereas I think of the TEPCO crisis. But you could also say the crisis that became a crisis because the situation in the company TEPCO coincided with a tsunami that was higher than maybe regularly would be expected. But it's an example where you can see that it's hardly possible nowadays to take a separate look at different types, because most of the crises that we have nowadays are actually transboundary, causing more complexity, calling for a response by many different kinds of actors, calling for more communication. Okay. Yeah, so that also means these mixed types of crises, that an organization can either be part of the cause, or it can be part of the victims. But in both cases, you can say there are also a group of societal crises, and rather than just organizational crises. And nowadays, companies and other organizations cannot just stick with only organizational crises. So they also have to look into societal crises, because their type of activities, even on a larger scale, can involve large risks with societal consequences, or they can have plants in an area where there is some hazard happening, or they can also be affected by, for example, the economical crisis. So you can hardly make any difference anymore between organizational crises and societal crises. This also means that organizations should have a broader scope, should prepare not only for possible accidents in the organizations, but should also be ready to follow the example of many companies. For example, after the Katrina, the earlier hurricane, it was documented by scientists that many corporations collaborated in a whole community approach to ensure that the recovery went fast enough after the Hurricane Katrina. So companies that are active in an area, they can do so because they're simply part of it, so they also need other partners. But they can also do that because of their social responsibility policies. That they say one of the ways in which we take our responsibility is that we will also contribute to the response and the cover-up. The recovery. That's funny. The recovery after a crisis. So this means that companies are at the moment actually already looking broader at it. So in the past, they used to have, and many still use that word, business continuity management. And business continuity management focuses a lot on, for example, ICT threats at the moment, cybersecurity. I have been doing some talks, it was again the Netherlands, but quite recently, for example, with banks in the Netherlands. And they told me that they still use the word continuity management. But in many other places, they have combined the approach of continuity management with their emergency and crisis management inside those companies, for example, an industrial company. And they have then used the word resilience to cover a bit broader spectrum there. I think it's quite natural to choose as an organization for an integral approach, because there is this wider range of risks that you need to take into account. And there is also important risk governance needed. And of course, it all aims at flexibility, early detection, fast recovery, and maintaining an at least acceptable level of functioning. Yeah, I should still add that resilience is something which we also found out in the projects that exist on many different levels. You can say there is resilience of an individual, of a family. So this is the systems approach that you can recognize, again, that is important for resilience thinking. But also community resilience, but also organizational resilience, and maybe national or international resilience. So there are many levels of resilience, but just as important as that is also resilience across different sectors. And there were some of our interviewees that told us that resilience thinking has progressed much in the health sector, whereas other sectors it has not progressed so fast. And actually, crises do not limit themselves to certain sectors. So it is important that after, of course, rescue is already focused on it totally, but not only the health sector, but also all these other sectors should have a collaboration where that is needed, where that is logical in a type of crisis, and especially in the recovery phase. That collaboration is often lacking and needed, because then the coordination by, for example, rescue is not so strong anymore. That's in the beginning. So they need to collaborate. Okay, I would like to ask a second. I've got three questions during this meeting to you. Can an infrastructure organization, so we take the example of VR, can it prevent or prepare for all risks? How do you see that? And at the same time, you could discuss how can it maintain current operations in a turbulent environment. So if you think about the example of VR, what is then actually a resilient VR? How much can it promise and where maybe we go beyond what can be promised. So please spar again, buzz with your neighbor about his questions, and Jenny will collect some answers to it.
Okay, let's start. The microwave. No, the mic is over here.
Sorry,
but somebody's hungry. Let's get things right. There was discussion that somebody might think this VR stands for virtual reality, but it stands for Valtion Rautatiet, so the railway company. So we are talking about VR, not any other kinds of realities. So who would like to start? Is it possible to prevent risks when you are such a company as Valtion Rautatiet? Where is the mic? It's over here.
Give you.
Just circulating. Now, come on, somebody. I'm just throwing it, and the one who catches gives us an example or an answer.
Okay, I guess I have no other options now. We were discussing that it's not really realistic or in such possible to prevent everything. Some problems that they have had in the past, they could have been better prepared for. So yes and no, maybe is my answer or our answer to this.
Thank you. Anyone else? Just feel free to share your thoughts.
We were discussing quite the same way, that we don't think it's realistic to be able to prevent or prepare for all kinds of risks. But what a company can do is to prepare good communication steps. Like if there is any kind of crisis, we will be very open and talk right away. That was our thought.
Thank you. Anyone else?
Which direction? Hannu, thank
some
you.
Some throwing is going to.
Oh, somebody, please help me with one hand. It's too deep.
I don't know.
Is it on?
Right, yeah, I totally agree that you cannot prevent for all risks, but then to prepare for all risks. I think that an organization should always prepare for all risks, to have some type of structure, regardless of what happens. And I think this was quite easily seen in Fukushima. They were trying to prevent everything, and when they didn't succeed, they didn't have any other options. They didn't have any innovations. They didn't have any structural approach how to deal with the crisis. So the organization should always have some type of structure how to deal with anything what happens. In my opinion, thank you. Mm-hmm. Anyone else?
Can I ask an additional question from you? So, what, in your opinion, what could have they done better or differently in the Fukushima case?
Yeah, I think first of all, the key thing is that they should have understood that someday there might be a way with cause across, so they cannot prevent. So the whole approach was, I think it was obsolete. Try to prevent. Try to be resilient, or try to prepare. Or I think they didn't have any plans of what if we of course you have to try to prevent, but then you will have to have a plan. What if this is not enough? What do we do then? They didn't have that, and I think that was what was missing.
Okay, thank you. Any other viewpoints? We have some reputation specialists in the front. Do you have any comments on that, on the matter?
I can build a little bridge to them, because in the case of Fukushima, we wrote an article about it that clarified that there were multiple reputation issues before this particular crisis happened. So there were multiple policy-related issues with the firming question, which is why I continue to call it the TEPCO crisis. But can you repeat your question now for the reputation?
I just asked if there are any comments from the reputation perspective.
Yeah. On the VR case, maybe. That would be nice.
Anyone? Maybe I'm pointing at... I'll put it in degree, so you can continue your debate.
This is the fanciest mic I've ever held in my hands. My comment would not exactly be about the reputation, even though I, of course, consider that to be utmost important. But I think also in regards to this question, the best thing an organization can do is to think that what makes them flexible in whatever given situation, and that is also critical for the current risks and crisis management, because even though you would know what the risks are, you still don't know in what order it happens, and therefore you, in order to manage it, in order to communicate about it, and in order to address all your stakeholders in that particular event, you have to be ready to kind of, in the current moment, to evaluate the different issues and important things. Yeah.
Thank you. I think there is another comment behind.
Well, the kind of risks have changed recently. What used to be called business as usual changed from nowadays in times of turbulence, a turbulent environment. So before was a risk, now it's business as usual. That's why nowadays we prepare plans, companies, businesses, they prepare plans, emergency risk plans, in order to prevent that the scenario that has been identified as a risk will not happen, but also to prepare itself on how to handle the situation, the risk that they have identified, and how to actually communicate it to the stakeholders and to the general public. So even for the VR, considering that one of the main roles of a transportation company is to provide safety for their passengers and service on time and all the rest, that is like business as usual. These days, that has been gone a bit, upgraded a bit, because nowadays we have terrorism, we have criminals that they communicate with each other quite often, and we'll raise the question, if someone gets killed in a train, is that VR's responsibility or it's police responsibility or so on. So it's a bit difficult to prevent and prepare for all the risks.
Thank you.
Still, you might say that it's not enough to be prepared, as the first suggestion was, at least for those matters that have already happened. Because I think organizations can learn also a lot from what went wrong in their sector. So not just their own history of crisis, but what is happening in their sector. That is definitely something you can have a much broader view about. Maybe from an IT point of view, Jari could say something about the level. So how do organizations, to what level do you need to go for a maximum, or so how do organizations do that? Is that a question that you can work with from a cybersecurity perspective, perhaps? Yeah? And we have so many esteemed people here today. So to what extent can we be prepared, or how is that done?
Yeah, well, I'm not perhaps the best person in cybersecurity in this house, but maybe I can say something. First thing is that I wanted to say is that, of course, you cannot prepare for a risk if you cannot conceptualize it. So in a way, you have to pre-conceptualize the risk, understand that this is a risk. If you don't reach it by language means, you cannot prepare yourself or prevent it. You asked about this cyber side. If I take this Valtionrautatiet, this is one aspect. Of course, we have such indirect risks, for example, that they lose the power grid. If the national power grid crashes for some reason, for terrorist reasons or something else, I think most trains would stop.
Yeah, asking.
So at least the transportation functionality would stop in that case. And I'm not sure whether they are prepared for this kind of situation. Maybe nobody would be killed, but transportation would stop to a large extent. Mm-hmm. Of course, they had this information system disaster when they could not sell the tickets. That was, of course, bad because they cannot provide the service actually as they wanted because they cannot sell tickets. But this is minor problem. Mostly, of course, there might be accidents also in a transportation system like railways. So there might be a major accident, for example, 100 people dies. There was one here in 1998 in about 1 kilometer from here. But that was just, 12 people died or something. Such things happen all the time. And they have to be prepared for that those kind of risks because there's always probability that the train crashes. There's an accident for some reason.
This is also a topic for economists, because of course there is a price tag involved. If you want to be involved for all kinds of risks, if you want to be immediately after something happened in 100% operability again, it's a price tag. So very often one goes, especially for the how quick you can be back to at least perform for infrastructure organizations that are so essential, to at least a certain level, so that minimum level is then defined. And how quick can you get back to that minimum level? And then, of course, you try to move beyond that and do better. So, but there's always this price tag. Also, so risks and risk preparedness, it also needs, in a way, thinking about it as an issue. So risk management is not something that only an organization does, but it can also talk with its stakeholders about the consequences and which risks actually society should focus more on than other risks. So there should actually be more of, a risk-related discussion in society and more risk awareness to ensure that people also understand the choices, that also political choices are made about that. And for a large part, that is not unveiled at all. Shall we take it on? Okay. So this related some of the things that Jari just said a moment ago, that risks could be more or less, you could be more or less able to conceptualize a crisis. And of course, there was this nice little book. I read it in half an hour, but it was nice, of Taleb, and it was a bestseller, so what am I talking about? Well, 10th editions. But black swans, he wrote about. Black swans relate really to crises that hit unexpectedly and could not have been predicted. And there was a lot of other literature that he actually did not relate to, that related to resilience, and a whole group of scholars working on it. And those scholars, for example, later explained that next to black swans, which are actually not so many, a large group of accidents that actually was mentioned as a black swan are actually dragon kings. Dragon kings, just as scary and just as terrible, but they have some features that are differentiating them from something else. So you can note that something is happening. So you can actually try to predict them. So for example, climate change impacts are not black swans. We pretty much know what's happening and we can work on it harder. So a lot of such are actually dragon kings. So what is an example of a black swan? Well, typically you cannot mention it because you cannot predict it. But I know from some mathematicians, some scholars in that area, that earthquakes, for example, you cannot tell which ones will grow. There are no differentiating features of earthquakes, at least that the scholars tell that I have been reading. So you cannot know which ones will really grow to enormous proportions. It's very hard to... You can tell maybe that it's coming, but not to what extent it will grow. So in that sense, we have dragon kings where we can predict a little more and we can do our homework for, and there are black swans. But of course, something very nice of Taleb was that he explained to us his second bestseller about anti-fragility, that it is, of course, not good if an organization would be trying to prevent all crises, because then you would lack any experience with dealing with a crisis. So he said, actually, some level, it's also okay if you still have experience with flexibly reacting to changing circumstances. So we should not exercise people dead in that sense. But I think we are way not at that particular level. Uncertainty and sense-making are very important in each of these groups of large crises and disasters. So some risks have ability to grow to crises, and there we talk about prevention of accidents, about awareness, culture. Then we talk about preparedness for disasters, which is about engaging, cooperating, exercising. You can see here that communication in many cases actually relates to not just messaging, but basically cooperations. Cooperation between the different sectors to recover, also respond and recover, and be prepared for these crises. But then there are issues, and those issues can also turn into crises, or at least in turbulence. So issues management is a discipline that is focusing on that, but also topics like corporate social responsibility are closely related because very often they end up in being an issue. And transition management is related to dealing also with disruptive change in the environment. And innovations are the more positive side of the coin of change for organizations. So you can say that disruptive change, but also controversies, go together very much. And in this field, I could also mention that for risks to crisis, where I was a moment ago, There is work done by, for example, Aino Ruggiero, Jenny Huvarina, Anna Laijelahti, who can't be here today. But also it is a growing interest of people like Laura Assunta and also Marcus Mukkonen did some work in that area and Paulina Paltela. But here, when we go to issues to crisis, we have a little bit different topic area. And here I could, for example, mention some work done by Nina Merilaine on issues that relate to human rights, or by Inku on issues that relate to Sami rights. But also Bojang Zhang, helped by Jari Vealaine, related to issues and the growth of issues in the online environment. Important here is that disruptive change is now happening, and whole sectors show this disruptive change. Energy, for example. In the 80s, we were already afraid that we would lose major parts of employment because of robotics or because of automation, we said at the time. Now we talk about the same matter, but robotics. So we expect that robotics will have an immense impact on employment, and through employment, of course, also on universities, because we try to improve employability of our students. It might mean that also the whole economical sector and how we divide income and how we reduce income differences, that all that should be taken into account. If the labor force is getting in that sense smaller, and more people might actually be active in areas where now you cannot make so much money, but it is maybe very necessary for a resilient society to do so. So there could be major changes through robotics, but also the energy field has already shown us a lot of changes. Let's take a look if there's something coming about that. Well, not so much the energy, but the controversy is already quite clear. You see here the Volkswagen case in the previous meetings of the course corporate reputation. We also talked about it. We did some research. Jari Vealaine was involved in that too. It also mentions that it's not only Volkswagen. It becomes all the time clearer that actually all these manufacturers are involved and messed with the data, maybe in different ways. Maybe not all using such quite obvious means of deceiving through extra software. But the Fiat Chrysler diesel emissions lawsuit is also since May already rolling in the United States. And what we now see is that the transition to electric vehicles and autonomous vehicles is already predicted within 13 years. So there will be major differences in what a municipality looks like, what the streets look like. Maybe in the meantime, we will have both systems in a very chaotic way still combined. Uber chauffeurs as a taxi, people that continue to have their own private cars. They might still be diesel cars. Maybe they cannot enter some city centers because it's prohibited. But there could already be like the example of the electronic and automated bus services in the Helsinki area. So we could have a kind of very confusing intermediate period where we have a systems clash and different systems are still in a way fighting for attention. It's what you see now also in the energy sector, where you could say there is an old fossil industry. And for example, now that Trump can make decisions, some of the old fossil industry is again reactivated to still have more profits from fossil industry, fossil fuels. So you could say at the end of an era where you see major disruption coming, it's never a neat process. It's always high conflict related because there are big interests that clash. People that can still make a lot of money using the old ways, whereas there are also new people who are investing to try to get new matters working. So it's really disruptive change, but in that period there is a lot of need for sense making, and we need to monitor So the old industry is monitoring what can we still do, how far can we still utilize the situation we have now. And old industry always has a very strong, powerful, because it had a lot of money. And it has low costs because it's still milking same ways of production. So it really wants to get in those bucks. And new industry is then trying to, and everything is then for a period really chaotic and needs communication, needs sense making. And monitoring is done by the old industry, but it's also done by the new industry. So they all want to find out what's actually happening. And for such situations, Wilma and I developed this idea of issue arena communication, because it's very clear, especially in these disruptive changes where whole sectors are in disarray, because matters are changing. And also we've been talking about democracy and ways in which now you see fake truths. There could also be disruptive matters happening in that sense. But we talked about communication not being anymore this peaceful goodwill matter where you have a two-on-two relations with some stakeholder. So the organization in the center and nicely organized, you had simply easy to define stakeholder groups. They were not mingled so much. It was not so chaotic. But now, as I told you, in crisis situation, you can hardly draw a borderline. So it becomes very difficult to talk about stakeholder groups, and also it is not a bilateral relation anymore, but more it is a network where many people talk about issues and they could talk over the head of the organization. So we already have to do, as my colleague always said, attention management in order to be part of that discussion and not be outside of the discussion that is going on. So monitoring multi-actor issue discourse is important with questions like which stakeholders are active and throughout crises, that of course is also very important. Which social media platforms are important? What are influentials that could help us in such discussions? If we inform them well, then the communication could spread faster. Which issues are discussed? What are the sentiments there? And how does it evolve over time? So actually, it's the interplay between all these different groups of actors that now matters. So not this bilateral communication, but the interplay between all these actors, the organization not being in the center there. And we still see, as so many of our current doctoral students now focus on, happily, the stories about too much messaging. Where is my transparency woman? Oh, there. So without listening and really interacting. I try to use some infographic stuff, but not too much. It is time consuming. So resilience is the capacity to function in turbulence. You have to be agile, resist, respond, learn, adapt, renew. I was in a position that for my host university in the Netherlands, I had a lovely research year where I could go to Twente University in the Netherlands. And there I could help a group of professors who all had also own interests but were aware of that. So they asked an outside visitor to chair their meetings about a new spearhead in resilience. So there the topic is resilience. And it's a very large spearhead for this university. But actually they're making matters bigger, so there's four universities collaborating really strongly, and this is the topic for the four. So they really try to grab it together. So for that we found a lot of, or I was also able to hear many different disciplines talk about resilience, because they all define matters very differently, as in, for example, psychology. Resilience is used very different than in, for example, IT. I chose the picture of an octopus because actually it's the only animal that we know of that has genetic mutation. So it does not change the DNA over generations, which is normally so. And so it takes then a lot of time until the genetic code of an organism has changed, because whole generations are passed. But no, this is, I think, the only animal that we know that has a direct change in its RNA. RNA is not DNA, but a similar substance. And it directly changes. So it orchestrates the production of proteins. So in an octopus, the RNA mutates directly when the environment changes. And if you compare that to we humans, who have to unlearn before we... Unlearning is way more difficult than learning. So we have to go through so much trouble. And this octopus, it's simply going there in the waters and it's automatically changing its RNA, and it's just all the time the best for the environment that it's in. It's amazing. So what is it for us? Its capacity to function despite disruptive incidents. Its capacity, meaning that it's not a situation, but it is something that can be learned, something that can be improved, that we can work on. It's a capacity to function despite disruptive incidents. So it is not just how to react to a crisis, but it is capacity to continue to function in an acceptable level, even though there may be disruptions. So that's very timely. So this approach is very important for critical infrastructure and, for example, high reliability organizations. If you want to know more about that, it's written in detail in the book. And of course, resilience has already been quite important in value chain cooperation, which is, of course, within the business school quite obvious to say. Because you can be resilient, but if your suppliers are not resilient, then the whole chain doesn't function in that way. And big firms have a lot of requirements for their suppliers. For example, ASML, which is a company that makes machines that makes these little things that are, for example, in your phone or computer. So ASML requires that its suppliers have, I think, 80% other companies that they work for. So a very high... So sometimes suppliers only work for this main contractor. But it's important for the main contractor, for the resilience of the main contractor, that they have a wider circle of people to deliver to, but also that their own suppliers are many, so that we're not stuck. So this whole is a rather systemic, needs a systemic approach. But this has a lot of literature also. But communication, of course, should also contribute to that stronger supplier contractor collaboration there. What types of risks should actually a bank consider? And how can communication help? Let's just see if we can get a broad list of risks in a short period of time. Think about it. Together we should be able to fix a rather broad overview and also see how communication can help to some extent. Go ahead and buzz. It's my last buzzing for today.
actually.
Should we continue? Mm-hmm. Okay, I thought that because you requested for a lot of risks, so that we could come up with many risks in a short time. So let's take the mic and let's hear one risk from each row. So Inku, please start. And then just throw it.
Well, if you don't suddenly have electricity, what will you then do? And how communication can help? Maybe we should first be more aware about those larger scale risks, and then we can somehow contribute to them.
Thank you.
A power outage.
Yeah. Pass it on the next row, and let's hear one risk from
next row.
And then there are the political risks that societies demand new things from the banks and make changes to the people's how they their loans can be covered, and you know, the taxation things and all those variations that society can make things more difficult for the banks. But the Bolsheviks come and take everything.
The risk of what if all the customers decide to withdraw all their money?
Oh. Reminds me of the 30s, when that happened. Oh, it was earlier, of course.
Phishing, or like security of the data?
Hacking. And phishing.
Yeah, well, for example, many banks are interconnected in a way that if like one goes down, so that it affects so many other banks. So not only they must like sort of prepare for their own like shortcomings, but they also have to see how their peers are doing.
There can be a strike that the employers are not working at all, so that could happen.
And then, of course, bank robbery is possible.
Yeah, of course. It's always possible. We still have a couple of more examples on the back.
I don't have anything to add, actually.
You can pass it on if you don't have anything to add.
Well, we were thinking about some cyber attacks or shots. So technical risks.
Okay, thank you. Excellent examples. So, do we just continue or...
Yeah, I think this gives a broad overview, and it also means that in all these different, if you would turn this into typologies, it also means that the communication is different in all of these different typologies. So what you can do, what you need to do is very different. I would like to continue a little bit along these areas. Thank you, Jenny. To go to this example of cybersecurity, where I put some parts of articles, newspapers. This reminds of Yahoo in February 2017 that warned customers, but only after they saw that their data were for sale on the dark web. So it happened much earlier in time, and only when the data became for sale on the dark web and they found out about it, they warned their customers, and there was a long time in between. And then, of course, this Finnish bank, OP, that was hit with a DDoS attack. That is maybe remembered by someone. It was, yeah, denial of services.
because too many people were hacking, actually. Or how do we say that? Bots were hacking. Importance of effective communication. Okay, so that has been acknowledged in these articles. And there was also an article that had as a headline, people power, making your people an essential part of your cybersecurity strategy. So I think that is also why communication is very important in this sense. This is a list of things, I'm not going to go through all of them, that communication can do to help prevent such crises and to increase preparedness. For example, it is about a non-blaming culture where you can speak up if you note that there is something strange. So in many cases, it has also been investigated by Carl Weick, for example, that a co-pilot, wasn't telling the pilot that something was strange that was happening there because of the hierarchy and the credibility of the pilot. The co-pilot didn't dare to bring it up anyway. So it needs a lot of training, but also a special culture within the organization to be able to speak up. Maybe you have noted in an industrial plant some danger that might be a danger, but you don't know for sure. Just to give you an example, I am of course very bad, but I was at Hotel Alba and I loved that hotel. But I was in the elevator and it felt peculiar. And I was thinking, is that just me? Perhaps I'm overexcited, I'm having this talk tomorrow. But I went to the desk and I told them the elevator made a strange noise when it departed and when it arrived. But I don't know if this is enough reason for you to act on it. Within 4 minutes, an employee of the hotel was stuck in So maybe we should really take our thoughts and intuition seriously, because of course then the maintenance was called and it was all solved. So it's important that employees in an organization, especially in an industrial organization, feel that they can speak up about matters, or sometimes they might also need special ombudsmen because it might be rather sensitive to talk about matters that go wrong and the quality going down, for example. During crisis, then, of course, communication can help in multiple ways, but also continuing the monitoring function and the advice, because we hear things from monitoring that can also be very valuable for crisis management, to see what people say about evacuating. If they may, for example, start earlier than intended and could perhaps block roads while doing that, well, actually the intention was to wait until it was really necessary to do such matters. Just a point where we could add information. This is actually one of the things that I heard from my American colleagues that is a problem, because in the United States, or at least related to Houston, etc., Matthew Seeger reported that a problem was that management isn't interested in social media monitoring results at all. They feel more confused by what people tell than that they see it as information to see, for example, how fast an evacuation is proceeding. And that's a major worry of our American colleagues at this moment. But interesting to tell to you. So, if I'm summarizing the communication approach in supporting organizational resilience, what do we get? Let's see, I made a little note of that. So definitely, it is needed to have a multi-issue approach, because I discussed that there are many different types of risks and different types of crises that organizations need to include in their attempts to become more resilient to them. And in many cases, crises had a transboundary nature. So a multi-issue approach is needed to change, because changes in the environment could also lead to disruptions, could lead to turbulence, maybe not always crises, but it is also related to change, risk, and innovation. And then, of course, multi-actor the approach should also be, because we need co-producing and partnering, co-producing within one organization through different disciplines, but also amongst different organizations. Or when you think of an area, different organizations are active in that area and need to collaborate when that area would have a major disaster or would have a major terrorist attack to cope with. Multimedia approach is of course also needed, and that's why we're all working much on monitoring matters and digital communication. So organizational resilience, in my view, is basically economic and social viability of organizations. So both the economic viability and the social viability of organizations. You could also, with one word, and I think it was a word that Mikko came up at some point, talk about health of organizations. So the health of organizations, the viability, and a healthy organization is a resilient organization. And communication, and that is very important, it is not just the talk. Communication is also in the walk. We should not only talk the talk, but also walk the walk. So, the book offers a vision, and there is still much more knowledge that we need, that we should further develop, and that could include all of you. So all of you can contribute to this theme. And similar to my earlier work as a consultant, I hope to have functioned like a catalyst, helping other people in my surroundings that also saw that some changes were needed, inspiring to ideas and directions, and also inspiring to the beauties of cooperation. Because sometimes Finns are so good in dividing up tasks, which is very, very important at the beginning of a disaster, for example. But we also need to join hands. And I've actually seen a big difference over time here also in how our students work, and where they now seem to be really well collaborating with one of another. So being in Finland has also inspired me to do new types of research. And it also gave me some peace of mind that I lacked earlier in the hectics of my native country. So that involved projects with partners, projects with other disciplines that I really enjoyed a lot. And I also enjoyed very much the working with students, because they were always willing to learn more about the topic and also to tell what they already knew and to bring up matters that were important in their frame of reference. And I would like to refer especially to Imago there and the different boards that we had over the years, and I think we are blessed with such an active group of students. So, and then the doctoral students that I told you about, 15 over the years, not counting those, because there's also some that start to do other adventures, but 15 that are now or have been very active in those years. So as this is my last lecture as a full professor, I would like to also present some small tokens and a printed book. And I would like to start, and maybe you recognize this symbol, with one. And oh, and I will mention a whole list of people, because that's more practical in time also. Could we get downstairs? First, the first group is related to my discipline. Could be many of you, but I am now asking especially for Wilma, Laura, Aino, could you come here? Andra, Matthias, Hannah Reinhardt. Kaisa couldn't come, but we have Taina. Let's for today take Taina in too, because she is all the time helping us with something new, but I think she also really belongs to us. And then of course Markus Mukane, who also was a contributor to the book in the form of one of the chapters, thank you. And Jenny Huwarine, symbolic for our former project researchers. And is Apeli, I saw Apeli here, where's Apeli? Could you please come here to a representative of our important contacts with the students? Wilma, you as the first. Thank you so much. And maybe Jenny is mentioned here, but she can maybe still help with the other matters also. And then I can already move on, because I would like to ask if maybe Hanna-Lena could come down, because she has meant a lot for us and gave us a very warm welcome. And I think Kirsi isn't here, but
she's coming.
Well, she'll get it later. And well, maybe we can do that individually, because here was this other one. Thank you very much for your welcome to the team.
Thank you so much.
And of course, I should hold the tulip like this so that it doesn't lose.
Yes.
Thanks a lot. And then I would love to thank symbolically for all our project partners. And I know he just loves or hates all these modern things. Hannu Rantanen, could you please come here? And Jari, could you do that too? I know you don't like fuss, but you're very important to symbolize the work that we have been done. So here for you. And many thanks, Jari, for the wonderful collaboration, including issue spread in social media. And was that all? No, it was of course not all, but I can't mention. Yes, the best one is still to come. I don't even need my notes, but I'm just making sure that it is actually just one that I wanted to... Yes, of course, and that's by Fadjukov, for providing for my team the best research environment ever. And that is symbolical for all other people, for Agora Center. And I would also love to give you this book and something when you want to know where your page is, some art of the Netherlands. Thank you, and it was really the best place ever. Although, of course, we're trying to be very happy at the business school now, too. So I have to be really political about it. But great work done. Thank you. And then there were some people that I was almost forgetting still, and that is Sari Makakangas of my previous department. Sari, for being here and for all the years that you made everything work in the midst of many crises. I think I will end this now. Quickly giving one more here. And I hope I didn't forget any essential people. I probably did. But I still have some books. So I can correct you. Okay, well, the rest will come later. So thank you very much for making these 11 years for me so very nice, new, novel, let's say a blank page where I could develop many things, and did that with pleasure. And also thanks to the students.
Dear Marita, this was quite an emotional journey that we've had here with you for 10, 11 years. And to show everyone what we've been through, we've come up with your journey. And in a minute, you'll see it up there.
It's 20 degrees in the Netherlands now. I see it's cold there.
Okay. So let's see the beginning. Before we ever met you, we heard of you. And we are starting with the year 2005, when the present professor Jaakko Lehtonen suggested that maybe we should take Marita Vos as a respondent and a reviewer for my doctoral dissertation.
Yes, that's true.
And I had no clue, and there was no Google that active at that point, that I would have been able to just use that so well. And I just started to wonder what and who and how. But I very soon found out that you had lots of good comments. So I knew you through 5 pages of comments. They were very supportive. Yes, they're very small print also. So in that way, it was a good thing. And after that, in 2006, who met Marita in 2006? Would you please get up the people who met Marita in 2006? Because what we're going to do is share the journey. So every year that we go, we can pass the mic to people who can just say where you met Marita in 2006 and what do you remember from that meeting. And it can be anything that you remember. So let's start here.
So hi. I was actually amanuensis at the Department of Communication in 2006 when Marita started to work there. And I have to say that you were pretty brave to come up here, you know, in the middle of the forest and start working with us because, you know, the university at that time didn't have that much, you know, like support for people working who were coming from other parts of the world. We didn't have that much, you know, materials in English. All our meetings were in Finnish, and all our emails were also in Finnish. And I think you were very brave in joining us, and very quickly you picked up everything and started to be like a 100% there. So very nice.
Maybe I shall continue. My name is Pauliina, and I was assistant, I think, by the time that you joined the team. I don't remember the first day we met because I'm lousy in these things, but I do remember what Jaakko Lehtonen said. He said something like, there is a professor found and that she's really good. And that happened to be very true. And I also shared the same what Hanna here said, that, and what you said in the beginning of your lecture, that I think we also felt really strongly that you developed and formed the team for organizational communication by that time. So it was really nice to be on board.
Kuka oli vielä kaksi kiinni?
Hi everyone, my name is Markus, and I think we met first time, it was 2006, and I was coming into your working room in Tourula, and I think my first words to you were that we have some issues. It was me and Eero Lahtinen, a fellow student back then, and we have some coursework to do, and we have some problems with it, and that were the first words to you from us.
Became the issue arena.
But there was also the word mingle that we heard about.
Very cool. So 2006, in the picture you see a bunch of penguins. They are representing doctoral students here. Because as we all know, the ultimate product of a professor is not a student or a graduate or even a doctoral student or even a PhD, but it is another professor. What does an apple tree do? It produces another apple tree. What does a professor do? It produces another professor. So in that way, I could say that you have been very successful because I would say that I am a professor all because of you. Your help, your support. Without that, it would not have happened. But let's move on with the story. We have the penguins in line. Here is Marita and Henni coming to Finland. They come by car. And Henni is very good at cooking, so he brings his utensils with him. Mm-hmm. Let's move on to 2007. Who met Marita for the first time in 2007? Okay, here we go. Laura has the catch box.
I kind of have this already. Well, I'm not sure, was it? I think it was, it must have been 2007. And my first
meeting which I remember with you is about when I was starting my PhD. I told you that, yeah, I can do the research, but I will never go to the defense. No way. And you told me very nicely that I will not let that happen before you are ready for it. I don't know whether it was because of that that it took so long, but I was so slow to learn to be strong enough, but I would say you made me strong enough. And I kind of enjoyed the moment in the end. So thank you very much. Who else? Where I
have people all over the room, so throw around.
I can't see anybody. Who? There.
Halfway.
Oh, okay. Okay, my name is Outi, and I'm not quite sure, but I think that I met Mari the first time when we had our inaugural lecture at the same time in 2007. That was, I think, the 2nd of May, so I never forget that day, because the 1st of May was different for me at that time, preparing for the lecture. And after that, I think we have been good friends and had some projects together, and I will remember you always, and I hope that you will visit Jyväskylä after this day sometimes or several times.
Thank you, Outi. It doesn't break, don't worry.
Yes, I think, I'm not quite sure if we met in 2007, but we were preparing the crisis communication score project plan, which started in 2008. And I was then working in the emergency services college, or Pelastusopisto in Finnish. And then we did that project, and also the other one, the PEP project. And what was funny with the, or nice, or very convenient to work with Marita, because she wrote the whole application, and that made it. It was very coherent and very fluent and very easy to read. Because I've been working also for the commission to evaluating these papers, and sometimes they are really a mess when different people have putting them together. But Marita was doing it herself, and I remember the PEP project. She was sending us an email just maybe a week before the deadline and saying, now as you see the other consortiums, they are very busy trying to put them applications together, but I can inform you that our application has been already delivered. So that was very convenient. The drawback was that usually it took the first year for us to figure out what we are supposed to do in this project. But otherwise it was very convenient. Thank you.
Thank you. That reminds me that I forgot to thank Elina Humala.
Okay. Yes, my name is Mikko Pitkinen. And I think this was the year 2007. I met Marita on the phone. I wasn't working at University of Jyväskylä, then I was working at Tekes doing EU advisory things, so funding programs, and I got a call from somebody, Marita. Now I learned to know you better later on, but you were kind of interviewing me on how to make a good EU proposal, and I was kind of replying, telling you all the secrets, and I was thinking, this lady, she can ask questions, she can ask the right questions, she could listen, she could learn, and you can see a lot of things, a lot of good projects that we eventually made also together. So I think that was the first acquaintance in a VR train.
And then we started the project together in the Agora Center, and we also hired Mikko Mikko to the Agora Center, and we got your good projects there, and I also felt as you that it was always so easy to collaborate with you. You all always knew the right questions and the right things to how to manage projects really easily, and it's really makes a difference also in running the projects if you are working with some professor who is actually knowing what she's doing and keeping, you know, things clear all the time. And I admired how you made the plan so supportive also to the doctoral students, like Jenny was there, and the project plans were very, very good for everybody who were in those projects. I could really see that. Mm-hmm. It was a really nice thing.
That reminds me of thanks to Susan Inhorn and Anne.
Thank you. And she wasn't able to come.
Yeah, I know. But she wrote.
Okay, good.
Okay, thank you, Kaija and Mikko. This was, I remember. It's good. So one thing that we note from 2008 was your ability to build a team. Because before 2008, just like Pauline and Hanna were talking about, nobody really had a team. Nobody really worked together. It was more like individuals doing their own thing and then by accident meeting once in a few weeks in a meeting to discuss how are we going to teach these things to students that everybody did in their own field. And you really did a good job with that. And then moving on to 2008, do we have any 2008ers?
Okay, hi, I'm Sari Mäkikangas, and I must admit that I don't remember the exact moment when we met, but it must have been in the beginning of 2008 when I started to work as amanuensis at the Department of Communication in Tourula. And I think that we've had a quite good cooperation from the beginning, but it must have been in the beginning of 2008.
That reminds me that I had on my list to thank also, for example, Marco Sitona and many other people in the department.
Okay.
To tell Marco at least.
Yeah. Okay. Was there someone else?
And at that time, you already had your first projects, wasn't that true?
Yeah.
They were running.
Yeah.
You also had books all the time, and we didn't really understand how that was possible because you were teaching full-time, having full-time projects, living in a foreign country, having to translate every single document.
But I just didn't need to cook.
Yeah, that really explains the whole thing. I am so glad you mentioned that. It must be the cooking that takes all of my time. So 2009, let's move on to 2009. Do we have any 2009ers? Yes, we do.
Where? Oh, no.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, my name is Päivi Lappalainen, and I think the first time I met you was it was about this AVI project that was added value of intangibles in organizations, and I think that the first time I met you, Marita, was one of the first project meetings, and I really have this picture of this meeting. We were having like a very multidisciplinary meeting and project, because there were like people from mathematics, IT, history, communication,
leadership.
What else?
Marketing behind you, all the
marketing.
Yeah, marketing and everything. And psychology, which we both are coming from. So my first thought, oh my God, how is this going to work? Because it was really multidisciplinary. And you were really cool, and you took very good care of the project. And I think that we had a very, very good time together, and it was, I still remember this project because after that I've never been in a project with so many people from so different disciplines. It was really interesting, and I really, really enjoyed being one of the team members. So thank you for this experience.
Yeah, so what I remember that I didn't about the same project, that I didn't understand anything which was happening at first, because I didn't understand what the people were talking about. But Marit was really excited. So, and every time when we said something which I thought that this might be totally impossible for the others to accept, So she was very accepting. So it was really easy to work with you. Thank you for that. It was, as Päivi said, that very multidisciplinary program. So I have never been involved in something like that. So it was really, 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 really nice and interesting. Thank you for that.
Thanks. Also thanks to Agora Center for brokering this project.
Great. So then we are moving on to 2010. And by that time, you already had some tools and measurement instruments ready. So do we have anybody from 2010? Let's jump on to 2011. 2013?
2012.
Elina, let's bring it back up.
I'm Elina. 2012, I started to work here at the University of Jyväskylä. I met this superb lady who actually was a principal investigator for over 5% of our FP7 projects, and that's a significant number. And that is three projects altogether. And in FP7, we had altogether 56 projects. So you led really over 5% of them. So I have learned a lot from you, and thank you for being so welcoming and sharing your thoughts for so many. Thank you, Marita.
And vice versa.
Yeah, and actually Marita won an award for getting most EU money to Finland, to Jyväskylä here.
So, an active applying, I think it was actually. But
well, no, I think it was just the best. Okay. Just being best at this. Let's just call it that. Okay, 2012. 13. Hold on, Inku, wait for the microphone.
Good question. I will always remember your first email that I received from you. You were so open to my topic and already welcomed me without the formal decision of the dean. So,
that could also be seen negative, but yes.
And thanks for your support and everything.
Okay, thank you.
Gratidão.
Now, what happened in 2013 and 14? Some of the PhDs started running in all weird directions. Not naming any names, but Paulina and Jenny and... But you were very good at catching them. So here you are, running after them. I think there was also a new car purchased around some that time. Could be, maybe.
A nice SUV.
The one for countryside, right?
Yeah,
a countryside car for your countryside life. True. Anybody from 2013? Okay, let's move on to 2014. Who met Marita for the first time in 2014? Aabeli.
Okay, so I guess it's my turn to bring some student point of view to the discussion. My name is Aabeli. I'm the chairman of Imago RU, and I guess... well, I started my studies in 2013, but I met Marita the next year when I attended some of your... I'm not sure which course it was, but I attended one of your courses in 2014. And it's a small thing, but it's a nice experience. Actually, I think the first time was after some... To be totally honest, it was after some student party in the morning. And I just loved when you always play some calming music before your classes, like today. I guess that's the most, what could I say? I guess that's some minor detail that comes into mind, but I think it's really important. Thank you.
Good student parties. Thanks for
that. Okay, then 2014. Well, I can tell something about 2014 because that's when part of the trouble started with all the, well, the indoor air problems were going on in Tourula, they were going on in Zeta, they were going on in T, and that was a very stressful time because we were actually not able to breathe. And that does something to a person when you cannot get air inside. And then also in 2015, we started to have the first changes about university structure and also the beginning of our process of changing departments, the potential direction of that. Anybody from 2015? Who met Marita in 2015? No, let's move on to 2016. Oh, I know. You need the mic. Okay, don't throw it to her. Throw it to somebody. She's carrying a baby. Throw it to somebody and then hand it over. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, so I missed my year. I could actually pick on any year because I've been cooperating with Marita almost along the whole journey also. So I started as an MA student, I think, in 2007 or something like this, with Marita as my supervisor. And tomorrow I'm going to defend my thesis. So there have been a lot of milestones in between. But what many people have stressed, Marita's amazing skills of managing projects and helping students to kind of work in the projects and also conduct their PhD thesis in the same time. And tomorrow will be my then day. Hopefully, everything goes fine. And infinite thanks to Marita for everything.
And the same.
Thanks, Aina. And then something wonderful happened along those times. Many of the doctoral students started lining up beautifully and started getting their dissertations finished. So here they are, beautifully progressing on. And this is Aina, this is you. You can obviously see that. No, actually, this is Markus and this is Aina, because you guys are now ahead of this minute that we are here. So anybody from 2016 or 17 want to say a few words?
Voi, eikö mä sanon
Hi, Marita. I actually could have chosen also another year somewhere, maybe even 2006. I'm not sure when we met for the first time. I think it was one of the female professors meeting somewhere. Could have been a swimming pool or something where Aino Salinen used to take us.
Yeah.
But I now decided to choose the 2016. Because I think that was the remarkable year then from the School of Business and Economics point of view, that we were able to welcome you, the whole corporate communication team, to us. And may I at this point also use the opportunity to...
Yes, you may.
To...
Oh,
just to bring you something small from all of us.
Thank you.
Sunflowers.
Looks beautiful.
Thank you for the tulip. Now something else for you. And then something small.
Oh.
Also to remember.
Great.
That's for you.
Thank you.
I've really appreciated working with you. Just to maybe pick up a moment from last spring when you were tutoring. I was then also taking part in that. Some of the researchers at the School of Business and Economics towards the ERC grants. We will see, hopefully, something comes out of that. Mm. Just as an example of how I've seen you being very helpful towards all the people at the School of Business and Economics.
Thank you
so much for joining us.
So 2017 is where we are at, but I think most of you have met Marita in this year. Everybody who's in the course probably knows her well. And I think what we want to focus on right now is, this is our vision for you and Henny. So look at the last picture here. So the plan is that you relax. But because we are not so sure whether you are able to do that, we've given some ideas, because you're a pretty heavy worker. So because we remember you and Henny went all around Finland in the national parks.
Oh yeah.
We've got you the national parks of Finland. Because apparently you can't take all of them with you to the Netherlands.
No, but this is lovely.
Yes, yes.
Very well chosen. I love these nature parks here.
And because you had fantastic music beginning of every lecture, we've gotten you the entire collection of all that Frank Sinatra ever sang. Just to make sure that you don't miss out on any of the relaxation music.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And oh, because Henny might not be sure if you are, you know, still, she said he wanted you to not to think that much.
Mm-hmm.
I think we want to encourage you to keep making your moments of genius apparent still.
Okay.
So hang this up whenever you want some...
moments.
Some moments of genius when you need something to be, you know, coming in your brain. And also, in case you are very opinionated and you like to talk out loud about and comment on things,
mm-hmm.
and for that point, if some people don't know you, there is a button saying, comment queen.
Oh,
so
dear.
You can just wear that and people will know who you are.
The double connotation. But actually the Dutch will not be surprised because I'm this on a low level for Dutch. So wait until you meet more of us.
And then, oh. Since you are the flower girl from the Netherlands,
yeah.
I could not help myself to bring you some flowers.
Okay,
and I also, I don't know when you fly out. But I thought that you are so spontaneous, so you will give it to someone if you are flying out tonight.
Okay. Thanks very much. Beautiful. Thank you, Paulina. Very beautiful flowers.
Mm-hmm. All right. So I think Imago wants to say still a few words, but on behalf of the team of organizational communication and now corporate communication, we just owe our whole progress of the 11 years to you, Marita, and we are so grateful.
Thank you very much, Wilma. I'm so glad that they have you when I leave.
Do you need a microphone?
I think I'm fine without. I don't so.
We want it for the video.
Okay.
So as I. My name is Aapeli. I'm the chairman of Imago ry. I'm the on behalf of the all the students that have studied either corporate communications or organizational communications. We didn't want to let you go empty-handed back to the Netherlands. So we brought you something.
Mm. That's great.
And on the back side, there's...
Oh, lovely. Yes, great statement.
Okay. So, all the best for the future.
Thank you very much,
Aapeli.
Yes.
Okay.
It has been a privilege working with you.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you. Great. Thank you. Thank you.
This is the official version. And this is where the doctoral students are also named.
Oh, how nice. Okay, I'll put off the mic.
Wow, you have so much stuff. What are we going to do with all this stuff?
Oh, no problem.
We'll pack it up.